And our special guest tonight, Robert Zimmerman, his website, BehindTheBlack.com, linked up at CoastToCoastAM.com. Let's take your calls, and I have a few more questions when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. We are back with Robert Zimmerman and your phone calls. Robert, what about the propulsion system? Will we ever get away from conventional fuel, hydrogen fuel, and whatever we use, and go to some kind of system that'll give us some kind of warp speed?
Well, you know, there's two parts to this. One is the interstellar travel, and I don't think we're anywhere close to even being able to answer such a question because we're still developing the engineering for interplanetary travel. And in terms of interplanetary travel, we are moving away from conventional rocket fuels for interplanetary travel itself. There have already been several planetary probes that did not use pretty much for their entire journey off the Earth. Did not use conventional rocket fuels. They used ion engines. The probe Dawn went to two different asteroids and was able to do that because it had an ion engine. Right now, we have one probe, American probe, orbiting Bennu, a rubble pile asteroid, and the Japanese are bringing their Hayabusa 2 probe back from another rubble pile asteroid, Ryugu. And both of those asteroid missions used ion engines. And in fact, when Hayabusa 2 gets back to the Earth to drop off its samples, the spacecraft itself will still have plenty of ion fuel to be able to go to another place. It won't be able to do samples anymore, but it'll be able to go to another asteroid because the technology doesn't. It takes a long time to accelerate because it's not the amount of actual thrust is very tiny, but it's extremely efficient, and so you can run the engine for a very long time, and therefore build up a lot of speed, and therefore maneuver a great deal in the low gravity environments between the planets, and so these probes are already happening. Geosynchronous communication satellites have not used conventional thrusters now for more than a decade, maybe three decades. They use a variation of electric ion engine arc engines. It saves fuel, it saves weight, and it works. So we are moving in that direction. Getting off the Earth requires I don't want to repeat myself. This requires innovation and a willingness to try different things. And as I said, our rocket industry has been very moribund and timid for the last half century, and only now are we beginning to see some innovation. For example, SpaceX's Starship and Super Heavy is depending on a new rocket engine that they have developed in the last decade. That rocket engine, the Raptor engine, is the first engine built in decades that is more efficient than rocket engines the Soviet Union Russians developed back in the early space race years of the 60s.
That's dramatic.
That is dramatic, but it's also some shameful that it took a half century for someone to do this. But the fact that that engine is so efficient, it gives them the ability to begin to think about building actual reusable rocket spaceships, because it'll be a rocket engine they can put a lot of payload up with very efficiently. And so, once again, that's a development stage, and you get that development, and that leads to more profit and more development, and things continue to grow. So, yes, I think at some point we will get better and better technologies, and we'll be able to go places. I'm not an engineer, so to me, predict what that will be would be very dangerous. Once we have a spacefaring culture in between and on the planets, those people will have a vested interest. Necessity is the mother of invention, will have a vested interest to develop better technologies right away, much more so than we have on the Earth. And when they do that, they will probably come up with ideas that I can't even conceive of, and neither can anybody else.
Robert, have you come up with any person, astrophysicist, planetary scientist, who has been able to explain the Big Bang Theory to you? How the universe started?
I've talked to a bunch of many physicists over the years about the subject of cosmology in all levels. And I will tell you that as a general rule, I think that the theories about the Big Bang and dark energy and dark matter are good theories based on the facts available at the time. And having said that, I don't believe them for a second, because the facts available at this time are very weak, very superficial. Our knowledge of the entire universe from long distances is not very good. And it's an embargoed story, but come in a day or so, there's an astronomy conference going on in Hawaii right now, and there's a story that's going to come out later this week that relates exactly to your question and the Big Bang, and it relates exactly to what I just said, and it's embargoed, so I have to respect the embargo, so I can't say any more than that. But come Thursday, I'm sure you're going to talk about it, George.
Okay, excellent. Now, what about the multiverse theories?
Well, who knows? That's science fiction, as far as I'm concerned. It could be true. There aren't really a lot of – that's people taking the little facts we have and coming up with an infinite number of theories. You know, when you have very little facts, you can come up with any theory you want, and no one can dispute it. Even if it's logical and rational, it's not based on much data. Newton, you know, during the Enlightenment, this was a period where the scientific method was developed, and Newton, in one of his essays, complained that we've got too many theories. I'm paraphrasing in modern English. I would like to see less theories and more observation. And that's a problem that humans have. We have a tendency to speculate, opinionate, before we've really gathered a lot of facts. And science is built upon the concept that you have to hold off your theories until you've got some facts. And if you do have a theory, you have to let the facts determine its truth or not. You have to test it. And you can't just say, I've got a theory that works and live with it. You've got to test it. You know, Aristotle had a theory about the sun, the earth being the center of the solar system, and no one really tested it for decades. They just assumed it was right. No, you got to test it. And so multiverse and string theories and supersymmetry, these are all cosmological physicists' beliefs. And I call them beliefs because we don't have a lot of facts to demonstrate this. They might fit with what we have, but we don't have a lot. And, you know, when you talk about the far universe and what's out there and how the universe formed, you're looking at really tiny amounts of data from very far away and very far back in time, with a lot of assumptions about how far back in time and how far away it is.
Sure.
The precision of those measurements is not great. And so you have to go with this with a very big grain of salt. And one of the problems in the cosmological community over the last half century is a certain, I think, hubris about their theories. The theories might fit the facts available, but there have been a number of cosmologists that have acted much too certain about what they've got.
Let's go to St. Augustine, Florida. Mike's with us. Welcome to the show. Hi, Michael.
Hello, first-time caller and long-time listener. What I want to ask is, have they done any more development on the hydrogen into a metal, the first time that it's happened on our planet? They said it was supposed to be 10 times lighter for use in rocket fuel.
There's a lot of research, Mike, there's a lot of research on material stuff like that. Something like, if they develop hydrogen used as a metal, when hydrogen is when you turn hydrogen into a solid at very, very cold temperatures, you end up, they're not thinking of it as a metal that you'd build like superstructures of spaceships, things like that, super light. The technology, the gain from having hydrogen in those states is that you get a superconductor whereby electricity can be transmitted with no resistance. And that's a potentially very valuable thing for electricity and power sources, because you don't lose power over a period of distance. And for computer technology especially, this would be beyond valuable. And so there's a lot of research in that area. And there's the applications for such things, you can't even predict what they would be. So that's where that research goes. It's expensive. It's difficult. Once again, containing hydrogen at low temperatures is not an easy thing. It really is light. It wants to escape. It wants to turn into a gas very quickly. And so this is a major technological challenge.
Next up, Joe in Monterey, California is with us. Hey, Joe, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call, George.
You're welcome.
Yes, I'm glad your scientist is right on about so many things that science is starting to wake up to. George, I have to interrupt. I am not a scientist.
Not a scientist. I was just going to say that.
I am a historian. My job, and I've been a science journalist for decades, writing for people like Astronomy and Sky and Tell and Science and those kind of magazines. And I can tell you, my job in many ways has been to translate into plain English the jargon that these guys want to use. And so that's where I come from. So I'm not a scientist. I don't do the research. I'm not an engineer. I'm a geek. I like to...
A good geek.
A good geek. I really like to study what they do and figure out what they're doing. And then I like to question what they're doing from a very objective perspective. And good scientists, I've dealt with a lot of them, most of them are good, respect that very highly. The stuff I've done on my website recently on Mars, looking at Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter high-resolution images, these are stories that don't get covered by anybody else. No one's looking at them but me, it seems. And I've come across some great stuff on Behind the Black that it's just incredible what they're learning about Mars right now that just isn't getting much coverage. So, I interrupted you, Joe. What's your question?
Yes, and I'm glad you put that into context, that objectivity is very important.
Yeah.
As a scientist, we get lost in the science.
Yeah.
And as you show, that the multiverse is ridiculous. The butterfly effect is just to validate the quantum theories that really don't work. What I'm trying to say is, socially, as a social science scientist, social psychology and anthropology, what has mankind done to develop themselves for the rigors of exploration in space? It's my contention that spacefaring societies had to come to that dilemma. Do we bring our social order into space? Do we contaminate other societies, other planets, with our failures, such as greed and power and all the wonderful things that we find that's rampant on the planet? How do we safeguard and keep science pure and objective?
Well, Joe, there is nothing pure in the world.
No.
The great, to my mind, one of the noblest aspects of the human race is that we recognize we are imperfect, but we strive for perfection. That doesn't mean we can achieve it, but we strive for it. So we have to recognize that imperfection exists. Failures will happen. I talk a lot about, capitalism and freedom. Well, capitalism and freedom involves risk and a failure. Companies are not going to succeed. Some are going to fail. But the competition and the ability to use your brains freely to come up with your own ideas generates much greater success. And in the end result, everyone benefits, like the old saying, a rising tide lifts all boats. And to many ways, the human race has been, over the last 2 millennia in Western civilization, has been developing philosophical concepts, a whole range of them, some religious, some philosophical, that give us an instruction manual for living our lives, both as individuals and human beings, and as cultures. And I will place no civilization ahead of Western civilization, and most particularly the founding concepts that established the United States. That doesn't mean it's perfect. That doesn't mean the people here are better. It means that we have, over a long period of time, begun to develop concepts that create a good instruction manual for creating a successful society. If we recognize that, are willing to recognize that and honor that, and there's a lot of Americans today who don't want to honor that, and it's really sad. We have the potential then to carry that out into space and allow future generations to have the same benefits that we have had. The people that live on Earth today are blessed to live in the most wealthy, civilized, prosperous existence of any human in the entire history since the first humans learned how to build tools some several million years ago. And we should recognize that there's a reason for that. So to answer your question, we're part of nature, so we don't contaminate nature by going somewhere. We're part of it. But then we as humans have an obligation to use our adaptability to think and to choose and to make better choices to build a better society. And once again, it's not always going to work. Sometimes it's going to fail. But if we strive for that and take advantage of what we've learned in the past, we will do well. We will do very well.
Frank in Hollywood, Maryland's with us now. Hi, Frank.
Howdy, George. Glad to be back with you. Happy New Year.
Thank you.
I'm a proponent of not believing in the Big Bang. God's hand started all this. And if we have the blackness of space that always was and always will be, why can't we have a God that always was and always will be? Now, my question is this. Why do we can run up the deficit for exploration of space, but we can't run up the deficit for everybody to have health care. The president will call you a socialist if you say that. Now, I'm all for space exploration, but if they can't tell us what's going on, then I wouldn't appropriate a dime for it. Now, Elon Musk, if he sends his rockets up into space and sees something like a spaceship with all the options on it, are they allowed to tell us what's going on, or is the government going to muzzle them?
George, several things. One, Elon Musk's his Starship Super Heavy ship is being built with no government funds. He's gotten investment capital to finance it, plus he's bumping his own profits into building.
Right. I think he'd go public.
Are not involved. He is free. He's an American. He is free to tell us anything he finds. If that changes, you're going to have a very big revolution, civil war. I am a free American. No one's going to, no one ever is going to tell me I can't say something or reveal something. That's why I have a website. I'm going to speak my mind, and so will he. And he'll be in a better position than me because he's going to have a lot of success and money and profit. In terms of Big Bang and science, I like to call myself a secular humanist. I don't believe in a God from a religious perspective. I kind of look at the universe as God itself, which means we are part of God. I'm getting philosophical here. But having said that, I think it's a very big mistake for any scientist to deny the mystery of the universe. The reason my website is called Behind the Black is because when I was a kid and I saw those astronauts on the moon and I looked at the black sky behind them, I wondered what was behind it. And that's the main issue. That's the main issue about humanity. Once again, we can't help but ask questions about the mysteries of existence, and there is mysteries here that we cannot get a clear answer for. Is the Big Bang possible? If the Big Bang happened, why? You always come back to the why.
The why is the biggest problem out there, my friend. And we're going to come back and take final phone calls with Robert Zimmerman in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. On our next program, Raymond Moody joins us to talk about the afterlife. Looking forward to that. And then Lucy Pringle live from the United Kingdom as we talk about crop formations. Should be a fascinating program indeed. And welcome back. George Norrie with you. Our final segment with Robert Zimmerman. Robert, if there were a scientist or someone that you never had an opportunity to talk to, what question would that be and who would that person be?
Oh, that's an interesting question, George. My gosh, who would I want to talk to?
And it could be at any time period.
Yeah. It's interesting. There might not be a scientist I'd want to talk to. Because ones in the past, I might want to talk to them just because they, especially from the Enlightenment, they have the right idea. But, you know, I know that already. There are some people I'd like to talk to that aren't necessarily scientists but came out of that period. If I had a chance to sit down with either George Washington or Thomas Jefferson, I would love that opportunity.
Interesting. What would you ask them?
The people who founded our country were very miraculous people, and they established something that, based on, you know, once again, millennial learning in Western civilization, that is now still, you know, we think of ourselves as a young country, but we have the oldest continuous government worldwide, oldest. And it's the most stable for the longest period and produced the most wealth. And the wisdom behind that, I would love to be able to talk to some of those people about that. That would be my first choice, I think.
What would George Washington say today about this country? Would he say, not bad, or would he cringe?
He would cringe.
He would.
He would, because his farewell speech, which he didn't give as a speech, he wrote it out and distributed it in print. It talked about the import, and it was very influential for the first two centuries of the country, is the importance of self-government. And I'm using that term. It has meaning both on a personal as well as a national level. He talked about the need of morality in your behavior. And once again, we are free people to choose, and it is always a matter of choice. And if you don't think about it, you're still making a choice, but you may be making a bad choice. You got to think about it every step of the way. And he tried to. His goal in that speech was to put in the minds of future generations the need for to think about moral choice in anything they do. And he would cringe today, not because of specific things people are doing. I think he would cringe mostly because there are too many people today who, in their own personal actions, are not thinking about the moral choice. There's a lot of people who want to think very grandly about how they would like to establish moral choices for everybody else without thinking about their own moral choices in life. And if you screw up in your own life, you are not making a you're not in a good position to tell other people how to live. And he was thinking in those terms. Get yourself straightened out first, and then you may be in a position to understand how to do the greater things. And I think he would cringe because of what there are too many people who don't think in those terms today.
Let's go to Joe, Long Island, New York. Hey, Joe, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Bob. Two questions. First was, you've been interviewing people for a couple of decades, so you would have talked to astronauts, say that even from the 60s that was still, you know, active to a degree in, say, 2000.
Yeah.
And, you know, Elon Musk and maybe Bezos you've talked to. Do you see a difference or a trend in motivations, drivers, visions, personal visions in these people, maybe being inspired by movies or something else personal, in terms of their views of what they want from space? And my second question would be about the two plane crashes with controversy over AI technology not tandeming with the pilots, and possibly the pilots not understanding it or giving the pilots the wrong information. What do you think about that as kind of being ominous for, you know, AI technology?
The second one I can answer quicker. I think that a lot of the technology being, the engineers tend to overthink things, and AI technology and autonomous cars and too many bells and whistles. Keep it simple, stupid, you know, KISS. There's a lot of too much complications here, and that's part of the problem. As for your first question, that's first question ties in very much with what George just asked me about, who I'd like to talk to, and George Washington. The difference often I see today versus the past is, give you an example. I have an essay. If you go to Behind the Black and do a search for the word, the phrase, the forgotten word, It's an essay I wrote on Behind the Black just after Elon Musk, after I attended the speech in which he announced he was going to try to land and reuse his first stages. And he, at that speech, he was asked the question about why he came to the United States, why is he doing it here, because he was born in South Africa. And he gave an answer like, this is a place, as bad as it is, you can still make things happen. But he didn't really understand the foundations of why the U.S. works. And the forgotten word is freedom and the concepts that established the country. And if I had to say there was any major difference, he understands it instinctively, Elon Musk, but if there's any difference is that the past astronauts had a much greater grounding in understanding why America worked. And people today, they want to go into space and explore the heavens, but they don't really understand the deeper philosophical reasons for doing so and how to do it. And that is an unfortunate distinction. That's the one I can give you.
Let's go to Stephen in Cicero, Illinois. Hi, Stephen. Go ahead.
Yep. Oh, hi. I heard you mention earlier talking about Newton. And at that time, it's the same as today. It was influenced by monetary system. Matter of fact, he was a part of the monetary system. His job was to find counterfeit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But at the same time he was doing that, others were doing a lot of other work on simple experiments that shows us today how machinery works and whatnot.
Yeah.
And I had found something overlooked. And everybody seems to claim that they know everything about that simple, the simplicity of mechanics. But they've overlooked the principle that's in a book. And they all claim to know it, but it sounds like they never read the book. Well, I can understand why. It was the most revered book at the time by Leupold, Jacob Leupold. Everybody claims that they've all observed these experiments, but that book has never been translated into any other language.
You familiar with that book, Robert?
I must tell you, I'm not familiar with it.
Yeah, and if you ask anybody that...
I'm not going to be able to read it very well because I don't speak...
No, it's in Gothic, Fraktur Gothic German.
When was it written, Stephen?
It was published in 1724.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and there's a particular page in there that drew my interest because I was studying Johann Bessler. And it led me there.
What does he say? Tell me, give us some details about his specifics.
Well, okay, Johann Bessler was the first one that was said to have made a machine that ran off gravity. People keep on calling it perpetual motion.
Uh-huh.
It's not perpetual motion. It's just simply leveraging gravity in a gravitational field. Easy. It's a mechanical device. And it's a principle that he used that I discovered after looking through all the codes he made.
Well, what did this Leupold guy write?
Well, he the seminal book on Theatrum Machinarum Generale, which that was one of the volumes of his first encyclopedia that he wrote for the common man to understand mechanics, hydraulics. And
sounds like he was way ahead of his time, Robert.
Yeah, I would say that's interesting. I will tell you that if someone is, this gets back to, we talked about earlier, if there was alien species here on Earth, it would be a big payoff to discover it. If these guys developed technology that was workable, that could more efficiently function than any of the fossil fuel variations we have had for the last 500 years, There's money to be made there, and I would have expected it to have happened, and that's the best I can say. You know, to say no one's translated it, I find interesting, because if it's so good, I can't see it sitting undiscovered. If you know about it, then you have something you don't. It's proprietary, and it's something you can make a lot of money off of. That's all I can say.
Let's go to Bill in the state of Washington, first time caller. Hi, Bill.
Hey, how's it going, Robert? How's it going, George?
Okay.
First, I just wanted to, I just wanted to say for the record that I know that Beetlejuice going supernova may happen tomorrow, may happen 500 years from now.
Right.
Or 10,000 years from now, which is a short period.
But I was really amazed by, I was really aghast and amazed by the last solar eclipse we had. I mean, I was driving right in the middle of it, and I was like, wow.
It was amazing. Yeah.
So the Beetlejuice going supernova thing has got me completely fixated, okay? I know it may not happen in my lifetime, but could you provide, your best description of what it might look like in the night sky from here on Earth if it did go supernova?
It would be something you could see in the daylight. It would be very bright. It wouldn't destroy the Earth in any way.
It would be the brightest star out there, wouldn't it?
By far. In fact, I had a post on Behind the Black, this astronomy conference going on in Hawaii. There's a report of scientists have looked at a stellar binary system that's not that far away that, based on the cannibalization of one of the stars to another, they can very precisely calculate when the two stars are going to merge, and when that happens, it's going to produce a nova, not a supernova. It's going to be that's a lower level bright explosion, and they have calculated that it's going to happen sometime in the next 60 years.
Wow!
And when that happens, it's going to be brighter. It'll be as bright as Venus.
What a celestial event!
Period of several months. So in terms of Betelgeuse, it'll be a similar kind of thing. The situation with Betelgeuse right now is actually not as radical as a lot of the bad journalism that we...
Isn't it getting dimmer right now?
Yeah, but you understand something. They have been tracking Betelgeuse for a long time, and it has two different cycles of variation of light. The thing is a giant gas bag. It has giant solar spots on it. These are gigantic, dark, like clouds, dark and light. It's a giant gas bag. If you put it where the sun is, its surface would be somewhere around the orbit of Jupiter, but it's not very dense. It's almost like a vacuum compared to space.
I've met a few gas bags in my career.
Me too. So, anyway, the thing about it is that it has two variable fluctuations. One is a little over a year, and the other one's around 6 years long. And what's just happened in the last 6 months or so is those two cycles have have coincided on the down cycle. So that's why it's dimming so much, because the two dimming cycles are coinciding. It's kind of like, resonance with waves. They're making it dimmer. And this is just part of a process that we've tracked now for several hundred years. That doesn't mean anything. It's not doing anything unusual within itself. It's just these two processes have lined up. But it is a red dwarf giant that is in its late stage of the stellar evolution. So sometime in the stellar near future, which could be 10,000 years, even a half a million years, it's going to go supernova. It could also happen tomorrow. I wouldn't bet on that. But that's the story with Betelgeuse. And, if you're interested in this, you should then focus on stellar evolution and study it, because this is a great example of that, and it's a cool subject.
Robert, where do people still get your books?
If they go to Behind the Black, there's a list. You can get all my books. Genesis, in fact, we have a new edition out, and an audio version was just released last year for the 50th anniversary. And they're all available on Behind the Black. They're available elsewhere as well. But if you buy it through my publisher, of course, I make more money. I appreciate that. But nonetheless, they can all be reached on Behind the Black, all available. In fact, Leaving Earth is now available as a very inexpensive ebook rather than the hardback that was somewhat expensive.
Super. Stay in touch with us, Robert, and let's see what happens next Thursday with that event you were talking about. Could be monumental. Robert Zimmerman, space historian. He's one of a kind. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, Tim Banal, George Napany, and Puttant, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.